It's not just KUER reporters who find themselves with more to say after they finish their story. So we thought we would reach out to others from time to time to talk about the way they're thinking about the issues they're covering and writing about. So this week, Michelle Quist has agreed to join us. She's a columnist at the Salt Lake Tribune. And what's interesting about Michelle's work is how her job has changed over the year or so she's been writing for the paper. She's worked as a lawyer, spent time with a firm in New York City, also with the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. But when she was hired by the Tribune, the idea was that she was supposed to be this conservative voice, someone who could unpack or defend lawmaking in a red state. And she's done some of that for sure, but at some point along the way, she has developed kind of this new role. In some way, you could say she has become a watchdog for Utah's sense of morality. Like in the wake of the Me Too movement, she challenged sexism at the state capitol. She's gone after the Mormon Church for how they handle domestic abuse. And she gets personal from time to time. She opens up about her own life and her struggles, like the fact that she's gone through this divorce. Michelle says that Utahns are sometimes afraid to admit their faults, but that they're hungry for people who are willing or brave enough to do just that. This is More to Say. I'm Doug Fabrizio, and Michelle Quist is here with me to talk about this and other themes that have come up in her writing from time to time. And Michelle, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So when you were approached by the Tribune, what was the idea? Like, what was the pitch?
Well, the pitch was just, we need another editorial writer. They didn't necessarily say, you know, you're Republican and we need a Republican. But, you know, there was this idea that you know how to write and your ideas and beliefs and policies are a little more centrist than others on the board. And, you know, we're looking to appeal to more readers.
Yeah. And what did you make of that?
You know, at the time that I received the email, it was kind of a perfect time. Hmm. I had never thought about leaving law again and, you know, doing newspaper. I'm not a journalist. I didn't study journalism in college. I don't, you know all of the rules around journalism. I write through law. I was, you know, I'm a legal writer, and it's a different kind of writing.
Yeah.
But I received the email, and I thought, well, this isn't what I do now, but why not? You know, this kind of might be perfect for my life right now.
Part of it was going to mean observing and critiquing. Did you find that daunting, or like, oh, I'm all ready for that?
You know, I never really think of it in those terms.
Really?
Like I probably should have.
Yeah.
You know, when people say, oh my gosh, you're so brave for saying that, I'm like, oh shoot, what did I just say? You know, I don't, you know, there was this thing when I was in Manhattan in a law firm, there was a big American lawyer report on firms that had this glass ceiling. And somebody told them to call me. I had just been pregnant and had a baby and had a negative experience. And they said, oh, well, call Michelle for the negative experience. And they called me. I'm like, oh, yeah, let me tell you all about it. And then the article came out. And like a few weeks later, one of the reporters was like, yeah, I was so surprised you did that because, you know, now you'll never be hired again. And I was like, oh, right. I didn't think about that. So, you know, yeah, I'm okay with saying what I think. I think it's important, and sometimes there's backlash, and you know, that happens, but people forget.
Yeah.
So,
but you've always been this way.
Yeah.
Is it fair to say that you've become something of a critic of a kind of brand of conservatism that you've noticed in Utah? Is that right, do you think?
I would think so. I don't want to be a critic of Republicanism. I don't want to be a critic of, you know, Democrats. I just want people to evaluate their principles and apply them consistently. And I think that's important.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what you do. I think that's the idea. It seems like what you're seeing is, look, okay, if you're going to talk about a principle, then as you say, let's be consistent about it. So, which kind of brings us to this article that you wrote. The headline is "Utah is pro-life," and what you said was, and this is something a refrain you hear from time to time from liberals, I have to say, is that okay? It's one thing to say you're pro-life about abortion,
mm-hmm.
It's another thing to say you're pro-life about gun control or about the death penalty.
Right.
But you waded in. Talk a little bit about that.
You know, I thought it was important that we were having this conversation about the bill in the legislature that was going through that was trying to abolish the death penalty again. You know, it keeps coming up every year because there is this consistent push to abolish it in recognition of the fact that, you know, I mean, conservatives especially, we don't trust government. We don't want government to be involved in everything. Why would we trust government on so many different levels to get it right, you know, to get it right at the prosecutor's level and the judge's level and then the, you know, in the jail? You know, there's too many places that things can go wrong to have somebody be put to death. There's just too many accident or, you know, mistakes. And if there's one, then the government has just put somebody to death, not, you know, without reason.
Yeah.
And if you value life, then that life, that innocent life, has to mean something, just like the innocent baby inside a mother's womb. It just has to mean the same thing.
And so you wanted to get people to be, as you said, consistent.
Right, right. And you know, with the gun debate, it was this shooting in Florida had just happened. 17 lives lost. Lives lost. What can we do to help that? You know, to stop it from happening? We have to have the conversation if we value life, because we're losing life.
How much more complicated does it make it writing about these things, writing about them in a predominantly LDS state? And from your own perspective, and we should mention you yourself are Mormon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It must complicate it.
It does, and it doesn't.
Huh.
I mean, I'm a faithful LDS member, and the LDS church was started with a question. You know, so if we can't ask questions now in a church that's infallible, then something's wrong. I think being here in Utah, when it's predominantly conservative and predominantly Mormon, I think helps us talk about the hard things, or at least gives an opportunity to somebody who's willing to talk about the hard things, because so many other things are just kind of accepted. You know, we don't have to talk about some issues because they're, you know, people, everybody agrees. Where do we not agree?
Yeah.
And what's the conversation?
You're not a native Utahan.
No.
So you're what, you know, this conversation happens all the time here. Like, wait, are they Utah Mormon or outside of Utah Mormon?
Right, right.
What do you make of that? And how do you describe the difference, if you do, if you see a difference? Because a lot of people do. They see a difference.
It's experiential.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in California, and when you're one of a few as opposed to one of a majority, it's different.
Yeah.
People look at you differently. You have to give reason for the way you behave, whereas here you don't. You know, obviously some people think that Utah Mormons are a bit sheltered and don't understand what it's like to live in, quote, the mission field. But it really is a different experience. In California, my family and I, we were there right during my family, not when I grew up.
Of course.
We were there during Prop 8.
Yep.
And my ex-husband now, but yeah, then, experienced blackballing in a partnership in a law firm, you know, because we were Mormon.
Yeah.
And you don't understand how that feels and how that affects you until it's happening. You can hear the stories and you can, you know, proclaim all you want that this is bad and I can't believe they do this. It's different when it happens to you.
But when you write articles that where you raise questions about the behavior of Mormons or Mormonism here. And I'll get to one in a minute.
Okay.
But generally speaking, what's the reaction? Resistance? How dare you? I mean, what is it?
I get a lot of private messages that are like, oh, thank you. I'm so glad you said that. It's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
I get a lot of public messages that are, I can't believe you're attacking the church. Are you not a member? What's wrong with you? I get a lot of that.
Yeah.
And I am a member, a good member.
What does that say about people? That they're defensive about their tribe? Do you sort of ascribe it to that, or is there something else going on?
I think they're uncomfortable with ideas or principles or practices. And instead of finding out why they're uncomfortable, they would rather just, I mean, the easier thing is to just, you know, oh my gosh, I can't believe you said that. Let's move on.
Yeah.
Rather than facing, wait, this doesn't make sense or this doesn't feel right.
But is that a Utah thing? Like going back to that, no.
I don't think so. I mean, it, you know, for in New York, it's probably the same with the Jewish community.
Hmm. So it's any insular community, any community that binds itself together is going to be resistant.
Yeah, we judge each other so that we'll feel good about ourselves.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. We'll be right back.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
So I mentioned that piece about how the LDS Church responds to domestic abuse. This was after Rob Porter, a Mormon, was fired from the White House for assaulting his two ex-wives. And these are women, by the way, who had confided in their bishops.
Right.
And their bishops said, stick it out.
Right.
What got you thinking about this piece, and how were you thinking about what you wanted to say?
Well, I mean, the news, you know, the news articles about Rob Porter, and the people I know, the friends I know that have had very similar experiences. The default in the church is for the bishop to counsel to stay together, to keep the marriage together, to forgive and hope it turns out okay. That's not the trajectory of domestic violence. It doesn't get better. It gets worse. And we're putting women at risk. And I thought that it was important to start talking about.
It's interesting because there's a balance there you point out in the piece. You say, look, there are good bishops.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are also others. There are bishops who are stuck in the past, stuck in this really dated, unenlightened kind of idea.
Yeah.
And you really tease that out in the piece.
Well, I mean, they really honestly do give out 1970s, well, they, some bishops give out these 1970-era marriage counselors from a conference talks, you know, from a general conference. It's just not helpful, you know, where it advises women to just be happy at home. Okay, I'm not going to, you know, you can't be happy if you're being abused. You just can't. Utah has the 40% of our murders are related to domestic violence. Like, it's an issue.
Yeah.
And we really do need to start talking about it.
You wrote, "We can be better. The policy of the church states that it does not tolerate spousal abuse. Then let's stop tolerating it."
Yeah. Bishops are in a hard place. They really are, because they are stewards over an entire congregation. You know, a bishop is as much a bishop to the man as he is to the woman. Why are we putting the bishop in that position? They're not trained therapists. You know, you go to a trained therapist and the therapist will say to you, you can't stay in that relationship. A bishop would very rarely say that. Very rarely.
It's interesting, this position, it seems like, that you're staking out now. Do you want to do more of this? Writing about the LDS Church, giving critiques maybe as a woman within the church, yet, I mean, firmly within the church?
I'm comfortable doing it. I'm not looking to do it.
I see.
You know, I'm not part of the give priesthood to the women movement. I do think there are a lot of things that the church could do to improve their treatment of women within the church.
And do you
I'm
want to
happy.
Write about that and
you
tell
bet.
Them?
Yes.
Yeah, you okay?
Yes. I'm happy to talk about that. Yeah. I'm not really excited about being attacked, you know, for my lack of worthiness or lack of faith or lack of reverence to the prophet or, you know, the apostles or the council that has gone out, you know, before.
Do you get that?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, because, you know, there's this, you shouldn't talk ill of of leaders in the church.
There's a story headlined, Does Being a Woman in the Legislature Matter? Where you say that simply that because men far outnumber women in the legislature, men's top issues are regularly addressed while women's are not. How'd that go over, that piece?
Yeah, the men didn't like it.
Yeah.
Like, no, the legislature deals with all the issues. It doesn't matter that they're just men. It kind of does. You know, it really does. Look at this past legislative session. Rebecca Edwards, Representative Edwards, tried to get through a few bills that didn't make it to the end, including pay for, I don't know if this was hers, but some bills that didn't get passed included maternity or family pay for state employees, incentives to businesses who provide family pay for, you know, men and women that leave for family reasons for temporarily. You know, none of these things pass until they play the, you know, the 5-year, this has been going for 5 years, I'll trade you this for that dance. Mm-hmm. And the men are doing that with themselves, but the women aren't involved. So I think it does make a difference.
It seems like when you're talking about those kinds of issues, they're very much related to family mm-hmm. issues, right? That's how you see them.
Right.
And this, I guess this goes to this idea about consistency again. It's like, I guess you seem disappointed that that's not a family issue or not perceived that way.
Right, right. I was the dean of admissions at BYU Law School for a year. I unexpectedly became pregnant while I was there. And, you know, so I start asking about all the, you know, the policies. What's the maternity leave? What's the pay? Oh, there is no maternity leave? I thought this was BYU. You know, I thought we valued women. How are we helping women if there's no maternity leave? And their idea is that, well, I don't know what their idea is as to how they value women, but they're missing something. Because the fact is, over 70% of women in Utah work. Women are working now. We can't structure our policy and our principles on the idea of that women are at home. Because while many are, it's usually for a certain period of time, and they're going to eventually be out in the workforce again. Mm. You know, we can't let them be relegated to secretarial and administrative positions and retail. We just can't.
So you mentioned that you're one to speak your mind.
Yeah.
Just always have.
Yeah.
is another part of the character trait there your willingness to just be brutally honest about your own personal life? Because this is one of the things, let me quote a piece from this was just at the end of last year. You wrote this. You wrote, I started the year married, at home with my 7 children, in line for an appointment to a judicial committee, gearing up for a private, successful law practice. I ended the year divorced, juggling 7 children with my young children in full day preschool, working full time. No self-employment. Dream job and political aspirations slowly slipping away. I mean, you lay it out there.
Yeah. I think people are more willing to listen to somebody who is willing to tell them that, you know, this is what happened to me. I also think people can identify, because these experiences and life in general happens to everyone. You know, you're just not out there sharing, and so you don't know that you have this shared experience. You don't know that you're going through similar things. And people want to know, you know, that you don't have the perfect Facebook, Instagram picture life. I don't. So,
how would you say the column is changing? Like, as you go, your voice, the voice that you're finding, the way, the things that you're interested in, the way you're approaching them, how would you say it's changing or evolving, if it is?
You know, I'm a little hesitant that it's actually evolving a little too negatively. I don't want to be a negative ninny.
Yeah.
I want to see the positive in the state that I live in, and there is a lot of positive. And I'm also a little worried that people are bored or annoyed that I keep writing about the same issues. The problem is I draw my material from daily news stories. And so because I'm still writing about women's issues is because these things are still happening.
It's front and center right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm getting a little more confident in writing without worrying about consequence. That's good and bad, though.
Why? What do you mean?
Well, because if I'm more willing to make enemies, then I'll have more enemies.
But you're willing.
Yeah.
Michelle Quist, thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to be here.
More to Say is a production of KUER News. The team includes Tim Slover, Lee Hale, and Doug Fabrizio. Subscribe to More to Say and leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts.